From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show on this Martin Luther King Day. Many of you are off. You're checking out the show for the first time. Stick around, and we hope you stick with us all the way through. Meanwhile, we're back in action because the news never stops. I'm actually in Jacksonville, Florida. I'll be back tonight in New York and then be ready to do the show and the five and everything else tomorrow. But we have to keep you updated on what's happening. As you know, bottom of the hour, Jonathan Turley will bring us the latest on all things legal. And, man, Joe Biden's got a lot of hills he's got to scale. And Ben Jealous is going to be with us, one of the leading intellectual voices in this country. He's got a great book out. And, of course, if you talk about Martin Luther King Day and putting his life and legacy in perspective, a man did not live to his 40th year, but yet impact still made. His book, Never Forget, Our People Were Always Free, A Parable of American Healing, is out for a week now, and it's just, I downloaded it over the weekend. It is excellent. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
And let's lay one thing to rest. I may be a practicing Catholic. I used to go to 7:30 Mass every morning in high school and then in college before I went to the black church. Not a joke. Andy knows this.
Really? Not many people do really know this, but remembering MLK, today we remember Martin Luther King Jr. We will discuss Dr. King's dream for America, where race relations stand today.
Number two.
This is a national crisis. FEMA deals with national crises. New York cannot take more. We point to the finger where it should be pointed, and that's our national government. This is a national problem.
Very true. And I give the mayor, Eric Adams, a lot of credit. That's the way you do it, Mr. Mayor. New York City's chief executive went to the border and actually saw illegals. He saw the problem. He saw the openings in the fence. He puts the blame right where it belongs, on the federal government. Yes, with the federal government, as record numbers of illegals crossed in December, we'll talk about why these mayors are to blame to a degree and why I think the visit makes a difference.
Number one.
Donald Trump has said from the beginning that he declassified everything, and he points to public statements like a tweet that he sent out saying, I declassified everything. Joe Biden doesn't have any defenses. He has said that anyone that would do this is incredibly irresponsible. And now we've found out that he's done it four times.
Yeah, and growing. You know those numbers. More docudrama, Act 4. Yes, more classified docs were found at Biden's Wilmington property, improperly stored, and the entire administration scrambling for acceptable answers. The question is, why is the president's team still doing the searching as many of his party defenders and the press go into attack mode on really the president for the first time? But first things first, the reason why many of you are off and there's been a national holiday is because of the life of Martin Luther King Jr. and what he did to push us forward in race relations. Ben Jealous knows all about it. President of the People for American Way, professor of the practice at the University of Pennsylvania and former national president, CEO of the NAACP and author of a brand new book, Never Forget, Our People Are Always Free, A Parable of American Healing. Ben, welcome to the radio show.
Thank you, Brian. It's always good to be on you.
Yeah, I know you were on vacation. You're skiing, but you took a minute off to talk to us, so we appreciate it on a special day. When you look back and study MLK's life, and you went to Oxford, you have the highest level of education. You talk to the smartest people on the planet. What stands out?
You know what? And I'm back from skiing, doing service with my son today. But you know what stands out is that we forget why Dr. King died. At least what he was doing. People think he was, like, assassinated during a desegregation battle. He was assassinated organizing the Poor People's Campaign. He was trying to organize people, white and black, across racial lines to assert their common claim for better pay, for better schools, for their kids. He was killed doing that. And we need to finish that work, end poverty, make sure people are well paid, make sure every kid can go to a good school. That's how we can best honor Dr. King.
So here we are. We have Martin Luther King, who many people don't realize, did not live to see the day of 40. People still reflect on his life. And he would be 94 today, gunned down in 1968. Yeah. And if you think about the fact that we see the video in the 60s and we say, how could you possibly rationalize white and black water fountains and bathrooms and hotels? How could you possibly have that level of discrimination? Sit in the back of the bus, don't sit in the front of the bus. for people, and I'm not, and I'm born in 64. I don't understand it, and I see nothing but progress today. How do you see it?
Yeah, as I talk about it in my book, Never Forget Our People Were Always Free, race as we know it, racism as we know it, as we've experienced in our lives, was created about 100 years into the experiment in Virginia and, you know, in the colonies at that time, early 1700s, not early 1600s, not in the 1500s. And so it's something that we've created and we can undo it. But the purpose of it, we have to understand, was to create a wedge to divide working class whites, poor whites, back then European indentured servants, and African slaves, and today working class black folks. That's the purpose of it. And that's why you could see all those buses and those water fountains and all that division, because these two groups in the 1600s were rebelling together. European indentured servants, African slaves kept rising up together, and the colonial government, they tried the military, didn't quite work. They tried new laws, didn't quite work. And then they changed the definition of a 600-year-old word. And as Dr. King talked about, as Mark Twain has talked about, try to convince poor whites that their greatest asset was their skin color, as opposed to their solidarity with people who may not have looked like them, but had a lot of the same struggles. And frankly, the two groups had a history of working together. So that's, I think, is the most important thing. Today, there's a lot of progress as far as getting, you know, people of color into positions that no person of color has ever been in, but we still have a hard time pulling folks together, and all of our kids suffer as a result.
Affirmative action could come to an end this year. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
You know, it looks like that's what the Supreme Court's going to do, that that's going to be a thing. And the question is, what do we do next? And what I would say is that affirmative action is supposed to be the hammer that destroys nepotism as the operating system of this country. You know, my dad's white. His family helped start Harvard in 1636. One of our ancestors gave 200 acres to start that school. And that school, your class rank literally used to be your class rank. It was not your grades. It was your money. And so that's where we start in this country. And we have a long way to go. And what I hope is that we focus on getting first-generation kids into school of all races, kids who grew up poor into school of all races. I remember in my book, I talk about sitting on a plane with a guy who literally had a Confederate flag over his heart, and I was head of the NAACP. It was a little awkward. But then we started talking, and what we realized was that, you know, honestly, his family had been trapped in the prison system in Georgia ever since the start of the Georgia penal colony. My family has gone to college since the end of slavery. He was really worried about the boys in his family because they keep going to prison. And he was the anomaly because Ole Miss had given him a football scholarship, and that was an old Ole Miss booster shirt he was wearing. And so the multi-generational poverty has afflicted his family is outrageous as it is for any black family. And so I hope that on the other side of this Supreme Court judgment headed towards us, we focus on the poor of all colors and getting them the educational opportunity they need, so that guy with the Confederate flag over his heart, you know, can see the boys in his family's lives transformed the way that his was transformed, even if they can't play ball that well.
That's a great point. I'm reading, you know, I did The President Freedom Fighter, Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, and the Battle to Save America's Soul. And Frederick Douglass, in his autobiography, writes that he's talking to other white kids who were his friend on the Baltimore docks. And they were saying, you know, we just got to wait for this generation to pass away because we don't see any difference between skin color. That was a hopeful Frederick Douglass in the 1840s because he says kids don't see. And he would go back and reflect on this. Kids don't see color. Somehow society gets imbued with something. And I think it's getting less and less. But when you're born, we see a flat playing field. And I think a lot of people listening to you and I right now don't see a difference between black, white, American Indian, or Hispanic. How many of those people are there out there? If I was to put a percentage, Ben Jones.
I think it's most of the country. And by the way, I thought your book was great. I bought it at the airport, and I read it over a year ago. Yeah, I thought it was a great book. You know, but at the same time, you know, the reality is that people are treated differently. You know, there was a book, I think it was called Marked, by a young Princeton sociologist who ended up dying young. And in that book, she said that in the low-income job market, like when you're applying for like minimum wage jobs, a black person without a record has a harder time than a white man who's been convicted of a felony, because most employers assume that all black men are felons. And so if a white guy shows up with a felon record and says, hey, I'm a felon, they're like, oh, well, you're honest. If a black guy shows up and doesn't cop to having a felony because, you know, yeah. he doesn't have one, they think that he's hiding something. And so, you know, that's what we're still dealing with. And I talk, as you know, as I talk about, a lot of that is on the media. You know, prior to the civil rights movement, the black poor were not shown in American media. It was just the white poor, for example, during the Great Depression. Public support for everything public was high. After the civil rights movement, ironically, they kind of only show poor blacks. They only kind of show black people going to prison, even though there's a similar number of whites in prison. And people then think, well, geez, everybody's poor is black. Everybody's going to prison is black. And then, you know, that black guy shows up for a job and he's just, you know, all sorts of assumptions are made that's not true. And so that's really, I think, you know, one of the last frontiers, if you will, is to really get the media to show the face of social problems that, you know, poor people have as many photos of white people as they're, you know, in, you know, relative to the proportions, and same thing for who's going to jail. Otherwise, people think that people, you know, who look like them, because right. society is so segregated economically, they don't realize the people who look like them that are struggling in these ways. And that's important. People still respond to images of people who look like them more strongly than they do images of somebody who looks like somebody else.
You know what struck me during that whole celebrity college scandal, making up rowing scholarships and volleyball scholarships
yeah.
for kids that don't belong with, who have average grades, who probably didn't even want to go yeah. to those schools. They interviewed some black students, and they started saying, now you know how we feel. Because a lot of them say, people look at me and say, well, you're only here because of affirmative action, when a lot of these guys have 102 average and they got a near perfect score in the SATs.
Yeah.
And now celebrities, every celebrity at Harvard or Yale, I want them to get that same look that we get. And,
yeah.
you know, for the people like, I guess, Brooke Shields, who had unbelievable grades and deserved to be at Princeton, there was others like the Full House people that didn't. And that gave me a new perspective on the downside of affirmative action. I don't need it. I remember Jack Parr was about to introduce Bill Cosby, this young comedian. We know he's had problems of other things been exposed, but he's the hottest comedian in the country. And Jack Parr goes, I want you to support this young man. He's really good. And out behind the curtain came a voice, and Bill Cosby says, I don't need it. I'm okay. I don't need it. He was about saying, prime the audience to laugh. And I sense that same thing from the Ivy League campuses. I don't need it. Could be the words coming from the students, because I want people to know I earned it. Do you want to tackle that?
Yeah, you know, again, you know, coming from a white family and a black family and a white family that frankly helped start Harvard back in the day, the reality is that it's the class privilege that you don't see in the Ivy League. I went to Columbia. I've taught at Princeton. I teach at Penn. And if your family is wealthy, you get in. I was with kids from wealthy families who literally had been admitted from mental hospitals. And you know, that's just a whole other thing. And then
I did not know that,
family,
by the way.
Yeah. If your family is a legacy, you get in. You know, and
yeah.
it's like, well, how can anybody ever compete with that? You know, if you weren't going here in the 1800s, if you weren't going here in the 1900s, well, that's never going to change for your family. And so we've got to figure out a way that really levels the playing field for everybody. You know, as I told that guy on that plane, look, affirmative actions have done a lot for women. White women have been the biggest beneficiaries by far. It's done a lot for people of color, but it's done nothing for poor white men. And we've got to create a system that levels all of those problems with the playing field, including the problem of poverty. And that's what that guy on the plane and I were talking about that day, which is that, you know, it was great that it was helping the women in his family, but they were never really as worried about the women as they were about the boys. The boys kept going to prison.
Right.
You know, poor white folks down in rural Georgia. Well, we got to have a way of dealing with that, too. And that's my hope for the future of inclusion in our society, is that we deal with this class problem. You know, when President Obama became president, 48% of black people were in poverty. When Dr. King was assassinated, 48% of black people were in poverty. Similar resistance in the white community to actually impacting poverty. And the irony, of course, is that, as I talk about in my book, that's what Dr. King was fighting for at the end of his life, was to end that poverty.
Right. Never forget, our people are always free, A Parable of American Healing. That book is out. Perfect day to download it. And, Ben, my exit question is, has a 1619 Project and Black Lives Matter helped or hurt the black community?
Oh, you know, I mean, look, you got to remember why Black Lives Matter was founded. It was founded, quite frankly, to stop the killing of unarmed black women and unarmed black men. That issue is as urgent as ever. You know, we can quibble about how the organization was managed, but the cause is important. And there's a point in my book where I talk about rural whites in Missouri on fire around that issue. I mean, you know, honestly, they got issues with Boss Hogg mistreating them, too. You know, and with regards to the 1619 Project, we need to have an honest conversation about history in our country. And my worry, Brian, is that we complain that young kids are being taught critical race theory. They're not. They're being taught black history, and the books that usually get banned are about that history. Yeah. And so, you know, I think we just need more conversations like this, listening to each other. I teach at a law school. We teach critical race theory there. No one teaches it in the second grade.
Ben, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Best of luck with the book, and I'll talk to you soon. Pick it up. It's called Never Forget, Our People Are Always Free. Ben Jealous, thank you. Your call's next. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
Challenging conventional thought and wisdom. You're with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, my concern is that a special counsel was called for, but yet hours after that, we still had the president's personal attorneys, who have no security clearance, still rummaging around the president's residence looking for things. I mean, that would essentially be a crime scene, so to speak, after the appointment of a special counsel. So, you know, we have a lot of questions for the National Archives. We have a lot of questions for the Department of Justice, and hopefully we'll be getting some answers very soon.
Yeah, I mean, why is it that President Biden can have his own legal team, many of which have not got security clearance, look through his stuff? They've already named a special counsel. I don't even know how they were able to do it before. I don't know why they decided on November 2nd, we got to clean that office. There was no pressure from the University of Pennsylvania. That's true. They said they did not tell the president to gut his office. Why did he have to get out that day, and what did they find? Then why did they tell the Department of Justice, start this up, and then we've seen a steady, slow, and trickle of document discoveries that are not helping the president? I think this is the worst period. So far, he's got about 20 documents. Now, I guess Trump, for six months after leaving office, they said we're missing about 300 documents. They found about 300 in his mitts. Got it. But Joe Biden had it for 6 years, minimum. And who knows what he has back to the 80s as senator in various libraries and residences. Why they're slow walking it out, I don't get. I know there's something bigger here, and I'll discuss that next with Jonathan Turley. It's Brian Kilmeade Show. On the road, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Thanks so much for being here. Don't move.
I sincerely doubt that Joe Biden himself threw these things in a box and shipped them off to the White House. I'm sorry, to his residence. I'm sure that this was a staff issue. Some aide who, in a hurry in the last days of the administration, was just grabbing materials and throwing them in a box. I think we even heard that it was some of this material was in boxes that included material about his son's funeral. So they may have seen, you know, Bo Biden funeral arrangements and thought, oh, okay, let's just put this in a box, not realizing that there were other documents intermingled.
Okay, case closed. That is Larry Pfeiffer on Face the Nation trying to rationalize Joe Biden getting at least 20 documents. We don't know what exactly they contained. Four separate discoveries. And who knows what can come down today. The latest one was Saturday. With us right now is Jonathan Turley, George Washington University, law professor. Jonathan, is that a good explanation? Some people just threw it in a box?
Well, it's one explanation, but it doesn't really answer the charge. You know, for example, the question of whether you grossly mishandled classified evidence is how you instructed material to be transported, handled over, this was a 6-year period. And by the way, direct intent can be established at any point during that time. So if Joe Biden actually saw any of these documents with classification markings, it destroys this inadvertent defense that they are relying upon. And the reason I raise that is because there's a curious thing about the last set of documents. That what the lawyer said was that they missed these documents in their earlier search. The question is why? I've dealt with classified material as an attorney for 30 years. Most classified documents come with a cover sheet with a border, a broad colored border, which can be red or yellow. Across the top are very large block letters giving the classification. It's pretty hard to miss. So the question is, were they just negligent in their, quote, thorough investigation or search? Or, and this is much more worrisome, were documents removed from those covers? And if that's the case, somebody clearly did know that there was classified evidence in those boxes and looked at the documents because they had to remove them.
Jonathan, the other thing is, why are they still looking? I mean, you put a special counsel there, and he's still having his lawyers look through it and then turn them over to people. So over the weekend, he said, this is what Richard Sauber, special counsel to the president, said yesterday. He said that the President Biden's personal attorneys conducted the search. They don't have security clearance. So if they identify a document with classified marking, they stopped and did not review it. Quote, because I have a security clearance, I went to Wilmington, mean Richard Sauber, Thursday evening to facilitate providing the documents to the Justice Department. Really? Well, I was transferring to the DOJ, who accompanied me. Five additional pages with classification markings were discovered. Among them, material with it for a total of six pages. The DOJ officials with me immediately took possession of them. Oh, isn't that nice? Who's making the decision to disclose and who not? What do they find on Saturday? Why can't they find it all at once? And now that special counsel's been named, why are they allowed anywhere near this?
Yeah, I wrote a column in the New York Post when he issued that statement because it raises these other questions. First of all, you're saying that you used uncleared attorneys to look for documents after, in this case, almost 2 months after the November 2nd discovery of highly classified documents in D.C., and that itself could be viewed as gross mishandling.
Yeah.
I mean, you're looking for highly classified evidence, and you still assign uncleared attorneys and just say, when you see the document, just don't read it. Under what security protocol is that the approach? And what's weird is that if he were the former president, I could understand that to some extent because he doesn't have a staff. This is the president, who is a host of security officials and the FBI available, and he could have easily said, go through those documents and with someone with a clearance, tell me if you find anything, remove it, et cetera. Instead, after numerous findings of classified information, they confirmed they still used uncleared lawyers. And what I ask in the column is why? Why would you do that? And the answer is control. You know, it gives you a level of control. So, for example, in these discoveries, what is lost when it's found by a private lawyer as opposed to the FBI? Well, one is context. We saw in Mar-a-Lago that they took pictures of everything, including what many people view as a staged picture in the storage.
It was, yeah.
But the FBI takes pictures of everything as they discover things, right? We don't know if that was done by private counsel. It probably wasn't done. Usually lawyers don't create records that can be used against their clients. So we will have to rely on these lawyers as to how they first saw it. For example, did you see a classification cover sticking out of a pile? If that's the case, other people could have seen it. Was it in or outside the cover? What was in the box? If you remember in Mar-a-Lago, they took everything that was in a box with any classified documents. That's clearly not being done here.
So the other question is, what else are they going to find? Who's leading this search? And the other one is, what started this? Why did you go on November 2nd? Because University of Pennsylvania was asked, and they said, did you ask the Biden Center to clean out? Did you ask the president to clean out? And they said no. And this is the way they describe it. Pat Moore, a Biden attorney, who served as general counsel for his 2020 presidential campaign and continues to represent him outside the White House, said this. Moore and another attorney who has not been identified arrived at the Biden Center November 2nd to help. While looking through the folders, Moore found a cover sheet that had classified markings on it and called the White House counsel immediately, according to the person familiar with the matter, who spoke on the condition of anonymity. The White House counsel informed the National Archives, records, and then the Justice Department became involved. We find out that everything kept top secret until January. We also find out that the CBS knew about this in November, but they didn't write anything about it until January. So that's another story. But we still don't know what caused him to have his attorneys, not a friend of his to rent a ride or truck and go in there, bubble wrap it up and take it out. So it makes you wonder how this all started. And the president seems to be totally left in the dark and insisting on remaining that way, which you have told me in the past has no legal standing. Not telling the president what they found does not help him.
Yeah, it doesn't. And at the end of the day, we obviously have more questions than answers, and the president's not willing to answer them. What's clear is this mantra that the president takes classified evidence seriously is really being undermined by not the day, but the hour. I mean, there's nothing in this fact pattern that shows a serious concern for classified material. A serious concern for classified material would have been once those documents were discovered, saying, I want someone with a clearance, the FBI, to go in and scrub everything and make sure that everything is protected and secured. Instead, they continue to use private counsel, and this went on for a couple of months. And the question, again, is why? And I think that when you look at the delay, particularly when the media had knowledge, you sort of have a partial answer of why. The Biden administration has long relied on the media to give coverage, they felt very confident that the media would have their back.
Absolutely.
And that's one of the reasons you saw with the White House spokesperson, Jean-Pierre, where she said with almost shock to CBS when CBS started asking pointed questions, we have a good working relationship. This isn't necessary. It was almost sort of a plea that, you're forgetting yourself. We're supposed to be working together.
So this is something else that people are talking about. First off, this document is classified. We don't know what's in them. We don't know why he had them. We don't know what prompted the discovery. We don't know why his lawyers are leading the discovery, because we know, and to the former president's detriment, they said, hey, you got our documents. Can you give them back? And he gave some back. And they said, we think you have more. Can we take a look? And they look and they start disputing what should be taken and what shouldn't be taken. And they say, well, in the meantime, keep it locked up. And they say, we will until we discuss it. And then they said, here's the subpoena. We want all the documents. And they said, well, we're going to get back to you on the subpoena. And the FBI got tired of it and they raided. You could find out problems with the president's conduct and his legal team, but they thought they were in a discussion. They didn't think a raid was even close to imminent. And many people looking back don't think it's even close to necessary. But James Comer says, let's just play this out a little bit further. Forget about the inequities between how two were handled. Think about something else. Cut five.
What the American people are going to see from our investigation is a pattern of anonymous donations going to Hunter's business deals, to the Biden Center, to the artwork that Hunter sold at that art gallery in New York. There's a pattern here of anonymous sources of money flowing into the Biden's pockets and Biden interest, and it's very concerning. This is a national security risk. That's my biggest concern, and that's why we're pressing forward with this investigation.
And the problem is they see the big donation coming from China, unsolicited, because they say it wasn't solicited. That came from China. The University of Pennsylvania says nothing to do with the Biden Center, but the timing is something that's going to bring in a lot of scrutiny. That's where this could go. It went from the president not handling classified documents in a legal way to why would these certain documents be let out? What did they say and who could they have benefited? And when you extrapolate this out, is there a storyline there?
Well, what I think is really fascinating also is that people are ignoring what was the original office that the Bidens were going to use. That is what we have learned during the Hunter Biden controversy is that negotiations had gone fairly far with Hunter Biden's Chinese associates.
Yes.
For them to supply an office for the vice president and his wife to have their names on the door, but funded by this Chinese company. So these documents could have been in a closet that was in an office actually paid for by Chinese interests. And that deal fell through because of other problems that were beginning to mount for the Bidens. But the fact is that all of these controversies, the influence peddling controversy, the Penn-Biden Center, they all come back to the same underlying problem. Influence peddling is virtually the leading industry in Washington, D.C. But the Bidens are standouts. I mean, they have taken influence peddling to a point that would make most people in the Beltway blush. And what these scandals are really showing is the extent to which the Bidens brought in millions of dollars using Joe Biden's access and influence.
And isn't that really what lobbying is? Hey, I used to be a lawmaker. I have some contacts. That's why Trent Lott and other people are using some of those contacts to represent major firms to make some headway with long-time relationships because they know how Washington works. So there could be something there. Well, number one, we're not going to have this problem again because I know for now on the American public want some security when it comes to these documents. Number one, a lot of things are on digital anyway. There's a lot less paperwork. But now on transitions, you're going to have security there all the time, especially when one loses and the other wins or one just term limits out. Don't you agree, Jonathan, this will not happen again unless somebody's really sinister?
I do think that it's going to be there are going to be added fail-safe systems put into place. Look, you know, the fact is I don't believe that Donald Trump should have had those documents at Mar-a-Lago. I think there are serious problems raised with how those documents were handled. There are serious problems raised here. You don't have to, you know, say that the cases have to be identical to raise these same questions over judgment and possible national security, you know, vulnerability. The one difference with Biden is that at Mar-a-Lago, you had Secret Service that were protecting the area, plus you had a storage room that had added security after the FBI requested it. That's by no means ideal. I still think he was wrong to have it there, those documents there.
Yeah.
In this case, you've got documents scattered in closets and garages that clearly Biden had no recollection of.
Yeah. I mean, but Jonathan, it's crazy. I mean, for him to say it was locked in my garage with a Corvette, it wasn't on the street, is the most insane statement. You wouldn't expect Donald Trump to make such a slipshod statement on his worst day, let alone a guy with 50 years government experience who was chairman of foreign relations to say it was in my car with my Corvette, a locked garage. I mean, you know.
It goes down with one of the dumbest political statements ever given by a president. It's right up there with I didn't inhale or the meaning of what is. It's going to go down in history as perfectly bizarre for him to say that. Although I have to say that if I went into his hotel and saw that hot Corvette and a bunch of Ukrainian documents, I'd take the Corvette.
Right.
But foreign intelligence probably would not make that choice.
Very good point. Very good point. And that will come up in your law class, I'm sure. What would you? That would be one of the questions, essay questions. Should you take the Corvette or the top secret documents?
And yeah, I flunk both. You if you don't take the Corvette.
Absolutely. Especially since it's been restored. And my last question to you is, could this thing go silent and then just keep saying, well, special prosecutors looking into it?
Well, I think that's what they intended to do. But I think it's going to be hard with the House. You know, we just found out today that they're saying there's no visitor logs on the Delaware residents. That actually doesn't end the headache for the Bidens. It may make it worse because the House has legitimate interest in who was in that home. And if you don't have visitor logs, they could seek alternative sources, which means interviewing staff and family as to who was in that house.
Right. We'll make sure that Hunter has a shirt on when he does the interview. Jonathan Turley, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Fascinating. Bye. And if you want to stay ahead of this, read Jonathan's columns. He's always a step ahead of everybody. 1-866-408-7669. You listen to The Brian Kilmeade Show. Your time to talk next. Don't move.
The fastest growing talk show in America. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
How big a mess is this for the Biden administration?
It's very, very big. Not legally, but politically, it's a very, very big deal. You know, this is a president who was marching upward for the first time in his presidency, he's got his numbers up. People are feeling better about the economy for all sorts of reasons to believe that he can now present himself. The fears that people like me have about how old is he and can he govern well, those fears would be dissipated if he were able to stay on that track. Mm. But now along comes this gigantic story, which was totally unexpected, and it's knocked for six,
yeah,
the original plan.
David Gergen, great guy. More leans left and right, but served two Republican and Democratic presidents, says this is potentially devastating. And I agree, too. But I never felt better about him being competent. He's too old. And I don't think he's been good at all. He's got 44% approval rating. But he's right. Things were looking better after that midterm election. William, listening on WTRC in Indiana. William.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So first and foremost, it goes back to he was vice president. What was he doing in possession of these documents to start with?
No idea.
Then we go on to further. It shows, again, his incompetence. And this man is leading our country. It shows incompetence, and I truly believe that it's going to be, again, the same thing the last guy you were talking to, about brushing it off, and, oh, yeah, we're investigating it. You know, when his wife just had some melanoma removed, they were hoping that that was going to be the news media story that was going to overshadow everything, and this would just kind of slowly fade away. What's going to end up happening? Nothing like it did to Trump, I can guarantee you that. So it is, again, the double standard is do as I say, not as I do.
We have laws for us, but laws for you.
This
does feel different. It does feel different. And I like to add this. The debt ceiling debate, they want that to overwhelm this story so they might even play harder ball than they normally would and help shut down the government. That's my worry. Brian Kilmeade.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade. Thanks so much for listening. We are on the road. I'm in Jacksonville, the home of WOKV in beautiful Jacksonville, Florida, where the Jaguars pulled up one of the greatest upsets you'll see in postseason history. Down 27-0 to go back to win against the Los Angeles Chargers. And then the Giants come up big, real big, and pull up the upset of the playoffs, beating the number 2 seed Minnesota Vikings on the road. Unbelievable in that deafening stadium. So we have a lot to discuss. Of course, it's Martin Luther King Day, which brings us to the Big Three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three. Sponsored by Crunch Fitness. Interested in owning your own business in a growing $30 billion industry? Check out Crunch Fitness at crunch.com.
Number three.
Unless they want thing to rest, I may be a practicing Catholic. I used to go to 7:30 Mass every morning in high school and then in college before I went to the black church. Ugh. Not a joke. Andy knows this.
Andrew Young. Where does the president make this stuff up? Remembering MLK. Today, we remember the Martin Luther King Jr. We'll discuss Dr. King's dream for America, where we stand today.
Number two.
This is a national crisis. FEMA deals with national crises. New York cannot take more. We're pointing the finger where it should be pointed, and that's our national government. This
federal
is a
government.
National problem.
Yeah, federal government. Just say President Biden. That's the way you do with Mayor Adams. New York City's mayor went to the border and actually saw the illegals, the problem with the wall. He puts the blame where it belongs. But just mention this president and he'll get his attention. Also says it's not just a New York problem. It's a Chicago. It's Los Angeles. It's a Charlotte, North Carolina. We have 4 million people came here since President Biden took office. We need these mayors to combine to show outrage to a president that doesn't want to pay attention.
Number one.
Donald Trump has said from the beginning that he declassified everything, and he points to public statements like a tweet that he sent out saying, I declassified everything. Joe Biden doesn't have any defenses. He has said that anyone that would do this is incredibly irresponsible. And now we've found out that he's done it four times.
docudrama Act 4. Saturday, the latest. More classified docs were found on his property and properly stored, and the entire administration is scrambling for acceptable answers. The question is, why is the president's team still doing the searching as many of his party defenders and the press go into attack mode, at least for now? Welcome back, everybody. Just keep in mind, too, at the bottom of the hour, Mark Kay, nationally syndicated host, also hosts a local show here, noon to 3 on WOKV, will be with us shortly. Let's go out to Michael Goodwin, New York Post columnist, Fox News contributor. Michael, it's pretty hard to overstate how much trouble the president could possibly be in, and that's what you write about Sunday.
Good morning, Brian. Yes, look, I think that the number one thing that you can pretty much scratch off now is how in the world could the Justice Department prosecute Donald Trump for his retention of classified documents if it doesn't prosecute Joe Biden? And, of course, the Justice Department has a rule. It's not a law. It's just an internal rule that you basically cannot indict a sitting president. So if Biden is out scot-free, then how do you justify going after Trump when it looks like, as you mentioned, Trump had more right as a president to have the documents? These are documents that Biden never had a right as vice president to take from his White House office, and certainly to have them sitting around for the better part of 6 years, at least. I mean, we don't know when exactly he took them. So there's a lot we don't know. And this idea of having his lawyers do the search, is that the new rule? I mean, do the lawyers have security clearance? I mean, you know, that a lot of this, Brian, I think just points up what I call the fact that Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, is a bitter partisan hack. He has now formalized two systems of justice. This isn't just on the QT. This isn't just sort of wink and nod. This is now out there in the open. We're going to do these two investigations in two different ways, one against the president of the other party we don't like, and the one against our president and his son, by the way, which we're trying to protect. So it couldn't be more blatant.
Here's James Comer, because you do extrapolate more than just, hey, how do these documents get near my Corvette, to what was how does this relate to China, the Biden Center, and Hunter? Cut five.
What the American people are going to see from our investigation is a pattern of anonymous donations going to Hunter's business deals, to the Biden Center, to the artwork that Hunter sold at that art gallery in New York. There's a pattern here of anonymous sources of money flowing into the Biden's pockets and Biden interests, and it's very concerning. This is a national security risk. That's my biggest concern, and that's why we're pressing forward with this investigation.
So that's where this is going to go, because he does not have a friendly house to deal with. So he's going to keep saying, well, it's being investigated by a special prosecutor. I can't talk about it, but it's not stopping the Republicans from pursuing these veins of interest.
Well, look, I think the special prosecutor is designated only on the document case. And so that's
Good point.
That's a single thread, really, in what is this other gigantic issue of the Bidens and China and Joe Biden taking money. You know, Tony Bobulinski, the former partner to Hunter Biden in these schemes, who met with Joe Biden, he's made an interesting point several times, which is that he now believes that this is no longer an isolated thing, that the Chinese companies that came to Biden, it wasn't just a business deal that somehow then the government recognized to be an opening. Rather, Bobulinski believes the whole thing is an orchestrated intelligence operation where you have multiple people coming to the Bidens with money, right? Whether it's the businesses, whether it's these other units of the Chinese intelligence operations smothering the Bidens with money.
Yeah.
And that this is not incidental. This was intentional, that they had targeted the Biden family, that they recognized the family wanted and needed money and would do certain things for it that were compromising. So at the end of that, Brian, you come to the conclusion that Joe Biden is compromised. That, and I think that's what Comer is looking at. And I think he has encouraged me in the sense that he is cut to the chase. This is not necessarily about Hunter Biden, although he's the conduit, or even Jim Biden, the brother. It is about Joe, is that they have targeted Joe through his family, and Joe took the bait. That's where I think Comer is going, and I think it is the heart of the matter.
So I want to go to, so the other thing we're looking at this investigation, the two ways in which they're being handled. And I think it's really going to work out to President Trump's advantage. I think that it's going to neutralize a major case. I think that to go after the president, period, is going to divide a country. The attorney general has to think about that. And now he's got a situation where he's got another president, a current president. And you got to say, well, I got no problem with this, but he's got so many more documents there. I'm going to have a problem with that. He had it for 6 years. Trump had it for 6 months. So we can go back and forth to a point. I think it's going to be neutralized. But I want to bring you to something else. I've been following the Twitter files as best I can. Some of it's confusing, but Matt Taibbi really sticks out with me because it's not like you called up Mark Levin or Sean Hannity and said, hey, conservatives, you never believed this Russian investigation anyway. Here's some proof. Matt Taibbi, as you know, leans left. He said, I'm from a long Democratic family. He can't believe there's no interest from other outlets besides ours. Here's his takeaway, what he told Marie on Sunday, of what he's learned so far about the entire Russian operation and how the Democrats were actually working Twitter, demanding they take things down immediately. Listen to this. Cut 42.
I think the major revelation of the Twitter file so far is that we've discovered an elaborate bureaucracy of what you might call public-private censorship. Basically, companies like Twitter had a system by which they received tens of thousands of requests for action on various accounts, typically through the DHS and the FBI. But these requests were coming from basically every agency in the government. We've seen them from the HHS, from the Treasury, from the DOD, even from the CIA. And they will send basically long lists of accounts in Excel spreadsheet files and ask for action on those accounts. And in many cases, Twitter is complying.
They're complying, and they're also complying with Adam Schiff. They're complying with Senator Blumenthal. And they talks about how they were told Twitter by Twitter executive, this stuff about Russian bots is not true. And they ran with it anyway, outright lies. And The whole Russia investigation is outlined better than the Mueller report falls short, if anyone wanted to show a connection. You look at these Twitter files, it shows a total deception, poisoning relations with Russia that didn't need poisoning, and number two, just helping to destroy Trump. This is some of the biggest stories that is bubbling underneath the surface and no one's paying attention to.
Yeah, I agree, Brian. It is remarkable. I mean, the Adam Schiff thing was particularly enlightening in the sense that here's a member of Congress, he's on the Intelligence Committee, but he can essentially pick up the phone or have someone in his office call or write to Twitter and say, take down X, Y, and Z tweets because basically I don't like them. They're false. The government would not do that by itself. But it's monopolization or sort of taking over Twitter through, sort of nice business you have there, or shame if something would happen to it. I mean, this is what the mafia used to do to businesses. You would kind of gut them for your own purposes. That's what the government did to Twitter. I mean, it even paid Twitter, which is kind of amazing unto itself, but over more than $3 million. But it used it to censor the speech that the government didn't like. And as you say, it came from a number of different aspects of the government.
And get this, Michael, what I did not know until yesterday was when Twitter said no, this is what happened. Cut 45.
The usual means is they would go to their friends in the corporate press, and Twitter would be hammered by, mainstream press organizations who would say, basically, Twitter is not doing enough to combat foreign interference. As you know, because you were reporting on it at the time, Congressman Devin Nunes got an extraordinary amount of abuse because it was claimed that the hashtag release the memo was boosted by Russian bots. But we now know, based on stuff that we've seen internally in these emails, that there were no Russian bots. That Twitter was actually telling senators, don't do it. You're going to look foolish. And they did it anyway.
And they did it anyway. So when Twitter said, yeah, I can't do that, they would get the mainstream media to hammer Twitter. So they were, I'm not saying my heart should go out to Twitter executives, because you know they all went left and they despised Donald Trump. But he believes they were underpaid by getting only $3.4 million by the amount of scrutiny they were under.
It is a remarkable thing. And I've written about this, Brian, in the sense that without even knowing, I mean, we're only talking about Twitter, but what about Facebook and all of the other? What about the search engines, right? Who was manipulating search engines and for what purpose? I think this is a major scandal. It is a modern scandal, exclusively in the sense of using this technology and using the private companies to enforce the government's preferences. And this is clear censorship. And if the Republicans had taken the Senate, I think we'd be in a different place right now. I think the House has already bitten off a lot of things. And so at some point, I do think there will be this weaponization issue of using the private companies to do the government's bidding. But just think about it. This is what the Church Committee did in the mid-70s. It was the CIA, the FBI, the IRS then spying on American citizens. I mean, this is the same thing exactly, only now it's using the technology as kind of the cat's paw to do it with. How this is not a giant scandal, but let me answer my own question. Why is it not a giant scandal? Because the mainstream media, as you said, was part of it. And it approves of it because it was silencing conservatives, particularly Donald Trump, or anything they didn't go for. So that's the big difference this time around. In the 70s, the media was hungry for the story. Now it wants the story to go away.
Understood. Hopefully things are coming to a head. They got to get worse before they get better. Michael Goodwin, fascinating time to be a columnist and a radio guy.
Yeah. Never go hungry.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Michael. Appreciate it. Hey, you got it. When we come back, 1-866-408-7669. I'll get some calls in, and then we're going to be Mark Kay is going to drop in, give us a few minutes of his time as he gets ready for his show from 12 to 3 on WOKV. He's also syndicated nationwide. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Calisthenics for your brain. It's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
A lot of people can't think of themselves. And not only that, but they've had jobs where they've been forced to, like, all day, every day, follow the rules, you know, listen to the boss, be told when to show up, what to do, and you just get into this drone mindset. And then there becomes an ideology that everybody in your business shares. And you have to share that ideology or you get pushed out into the fringes of the social group.
And he's talking about this whole green movement and how ridiculous it is and the wokeism that's happening in the corporate offices and how pretty much he believes it's a liberal brainwashing, and especially for the next generation. They're the ones pushing all this. And if you drill down, which he also did in his show, I had a chance to listen to him a few times, on what's going on with electric cars, it's great to have an electric car. You go make the choice, but just understand the downside is fossil fuels fuels the electricity that fuels those electric cars. And also know we're stripping the earth of its rare earth, by definition, problematic, strip mining, to get the metals to make the batteries. So in the long term, we're going to find this whole period folly. And if people just looked at this rationally instead of like Greta Thunberg, who is a kid, I get it, but off the charts and people worship her, that's not practical for this country. It's not practical. I mean, last week we were talking about what? Getting rid of gas stoves. And now soon we're going to get rid of gas stations. And then soon we're going to get rid of gas cars. It starts in California, and it seems insane. And then suddenly it seems a little less insane. And the next thing you know, 50% of the country is doing it. And if you don't do it, you don't care about your children. So that's why Joe Rogan's so valuable. It gets him out of the news. It gets him out of the news business and into the commentary business from a practical standpoint. And that's why a lot of people get some of their news from podcasts. And that's why. So listen, when we come back, we're not going to just talk about that. We're going to open up to talk about everything going on, including why this city is so aflame in Jacksonville, because the Jaguars, after being bad for so long, are not only back, they pulled off one of the most dramatic upsets ever. Mark Kay, locally and nationally, will be here, a rising star, to bring us insight into Florida and Governor DeSantis and everything else.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
I think Biden has highlighted his incompetence for the world to see. What you see here is failure. While the politics in it is lucrative, I'm more focused on the practicality of it. I want to know who knew what and when. Were sources and methods compromised? If they were compromised, is the intelligence community, what are they doing to mitigate those?
That is Congressman Tony Gonzalez. He's a common sense guy on the border, desperate for some attention. The president's not serious about it, obviously, and it frustrates him. He's also frustrated a lot with the right. But he cannot believe, as his words, incompetence of letting a series of documents sit in somebody's private offices and in their garage for as long as 6 years. And we don't know how many more are left. Mark Kay's with us now. He's got a national audience, and most of all, he's got a local audience on WOKV. Mark, great to see you.
Brian, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I mean, we have so many issues to discuss, including the Jaguars game and the big comeback. But I was taken aback. I watched it all last night, read some of the transcripts. This is the first time that I know that many mainstream outlets are very critical of this president on anything. There'd be one or two. There might be a commentator here. Everyone calling him out. I mean, it'll back off at a certain time.
Sure.
But calling him out. Do you feel the same way?
Oh, well, we have every Monday on our show, we do the Church of Liontology, where we recap the Sunday morning talk shows on CNN and MSNBC, and we just counteract whatever misinformation they're handing there. I can't find any anymore. I mean, we've got to change the whole scope of the segment because they are going after Biden. They're telling it like it is, and they're putting forth this idea that, wow, this is a real big issue. This is a problem. This is, you know, especially since he went after Donald Trump so hard.
So, Mark, if they do look into your background, just make sure you get the same deal as they go through your stuff and go through your bank records and your secret deposit boxes.
That's exactly
Have your
right.
lawyers go through it.
Oh, I spent the weekend.
Do not let the government go through it. Just say, listen, my lawyers will handle it. How does his lawyers get to lead this?
Brian, I don't know about you. I spent the weekend going through my garage, making sure I had no top secret documents lying around, no old tax returns.
Did you move your Corvette out of the garage to get a good look at it?
I don't have a Corvette. I'm not on Joe Biden's salary.
Right.
China doesn't pay my car payments. But no, it's really shocking because, you know, I tell my wife, I go, how often do I leave the garage open?
Right.
You know, you come home, you're like, oh, I forgot to leave the garage open. You go to bed, you wake up, the garage is open. There's geckos running around all over the floor because that's what we have in Florida. And I thought to myself, it's just, you know, the irresponsibility of that kind of thing. And then to come back and say, you know what, it's okay. My garage is locked. It definitely seems to me not only that it's an issue, but that there doesn't seem to be on the president's side, at least, a whole lot of concern that it's an issue, or he seems to be brushing it off, which I think is a problem.
Well, yeah, and now he says I can't really. He's reading a statement over and over again. He takes it seriously, and they go on. I don't know what these press conferences are going to be like, but Ilhan Omar seems to have thrown off MSNBC. They almost bleeped her when she said this. Cut 10.
I'm glad that there is a special prosecutor that's been appointed to investigate.
You are glad that there is a special prosecutor. Tell me
because
why.
Because anytime there is a deviance in regards to security protocols, that should be taken serious. It should
Got
be
it.
Investigated.
And listen to that. Now that we can agree, that's it for Omar. Listen to Adam Schiff, cut 9.
I do think it's the right move. The attorney general has to make sure that not only is justice evenly applied, But the appearances of justice are also satisfactory to the public. And he's a guy
I mean, I have almost no respect for. But I always say, what is the play here? Why are they coming out? Why are they all singing from the same hymn sheet? And a lot of people are writing me and say, Brian, this is the Democratic Party saying, do not get him out before he commits to running for re-election.
Yeah.
I can't get proof of that. I'm not, but this is what people are thinking. Why is this happening? What does Mark Kay think?
I mean, we hear that a lot from our listeners too. This is Obama. He's decided he's done with Joe. Yeah. He's planting the documents all over the place. I feel that, I mean, because Joe Biden, they had to pull him out of retirement. They had to convince him, look, if you're not president, it's going to be somebody else that we can't control. We don't know what's going to come out. So we need somebody to beat Trump. You've got the name recognition. They pulled him out of retirement. I feel like they could just have easily told him, you're not running again. Right. I don't know that they need to do this to him and really destroy his legacy and his career and his family at the same time. So, yes, that is a theory. I've heard the weak theory that it's the Republicans. I mean, The View, I think, is the only place I've heard that theory. But they want you to know it's the Republicans who probably
planted
these documents. Right. Oh, because that's what the Republicans. They've been waiting around since Joe Biden was vice president on the off chance he decides to become president to then put these documents in these places. But I don't know. Knowing what I know about Joe Biden, I think it could just be idiocy. I mean, no one's really throwing that out there, but it could just be a carelessness on the part of a guy who just didn't take it seriously.
I think it neutralizes the whole thing. And I think it's going to be very fortuitous for Trump. I mean, we always talk about the leaning left and what's going on in the FBI, but this would be so blatant. And because one had it for 6 years, one had it for 6 months. One's got 20, it's probably going to end up being 50 to 100.
Oh, yeah.
And then Trump's got 300. But Trump pushed back. Well, Trump gave some back. It's close enough where you have to basically say, when it comes to the attorney general, we've got new systems in place. Let's move on. For Trump, that would leave just the Georgia trial.
Right.
And in New York, he got fined $1 million. For you and I, that's like a dollar.
You write a check and you're done. Yeah.
Right. So he's done and he could say he's fighting it, but that's just about done. And then, so you know, he is even with Ron DeSantis in the UMass Amherst poll.
Yeah.
Can you believe that this could be setting up a rematch?
If Donald Trump, I mean, if you think about it, Donald Trump has been interestingly quiet about this whole thing.
Right.
And it's that whole
thing. I mean, he's putting things on Truth Social.
But he's not. I mean, I know he's got rallies planned and stuff like that, but he's not anywhere on the news. He's not calling in and he's not like being bombastic the way he usually would be. Sun Tzu always says, when your enemy's making a mistake, just let him do it. And I think he's really excited to see how this plays out because it negates your, like you said, the last quarter of last year was horrible for Trump. The first quarter of this year is horrible for Biden.
Mark Hayes here. Mark, do you believe that your governor's running for president?
I believe he will probably, I mean, I don't know. He may be sitting back. And people ask me that question all the time. He's a great governor. I don't want to lose him. A lot of the things he says and a lot of the things he does on a national scale make it seem like, yes, he's making a play for that office. But he also knows Donald Trump. He knows how powerful he can be with the base. And I don't think he wants to do anything that would ruin a chance he has in the future. I would say 75% he does run. But he's a smart guy, too, and he knows how to take the pulse of the nation and also his state. Here in Florida, he'd get the support. But nationwide, do the people around the country love him as much as they do as we do here in Florida? It's tough to say at this point.
Right. Certainly people do fear him on the left. I think I was at this Al Smith dinner, which is a big thing in New York.
Yeah.
And I was and that's when I see Chuck Schumer every year. And I went up to him. And the first thing he says to me is, you think DeSantis is running? And I'm thinking to myself, wow, where did that come from? I mean, that's how worried they are. They're not worried. I don't think they're worried about Trump. In fact, I think they back off Trump. They want to make sure that he runs because they think he'll if he doesn't win, their hope is he'll wreck the room.
Well, because DeSantis is, you know, Trump in a suit. You know, DeSantis knows he's from Congress. He's been a governor. He knows how politics works in Washington, D.C. He's got a military record. And he's got all the same ideas and beliefs that Donald Trump had. He's pushing the same Make America Great Again agenda, but he's doing it from a different position. It's not bombastic. And he's got a political background to back it up. So, of course, Chuck Schumer is worried about that.
So, yeah, I guess so. I guess it's kind of early. But the big story in Jacksonville, if you looked at the top five stories everywhere, is the color of the back of that chair. It's all about teal.
Teal with it, baby.
So this is an example like Green Bay, my humble opinion. Like St. Louis, the Cardinals, the baseball team. This city loves the Jaguars.
Correct.
And could you describe what that meant to the city, that making the playoffs number one, having a 23-year-old quarterback lead a comeback like that after a hideous first half?
Well, after a hideous last season, I mean, this city has been through a lot. With it's a love-hate relationship. This has been, you know, we get a lot of the, it's like that girlfriend or that boyfriend you keep going back to. And we've been season ticket holders for a while. And a couple of years in there, we are just doing it because we're like, look, we got to invest in the city. We don't necessarily want to go to the games. Who, you know, who can we give the tickets away to? But this year with Trevor Lawrence and with Doug Peterson and what they've been able to do, winning the last six games, getting the home, winning the division and getting the home game last on Saturday night, and then winning in true Jaguar fashion. A blowout would not have been a Jaguar game.
Right.
Coming back from 27-0 to win it by 1 point, that's a Jaguar game. But you were there. You saw the stadium. I mean, we don't get crowds like that at that stadium unless it's Monster Jam or Florida Georgia. You know, Gravedigger can draw them in, but it was loud. It was raucous. It was cold. Everybody loved it, and the Jaguars delivered. And for this city, we don't have basketball. We don't have hockey. We have one sports franchise. It's the Jaguars. It's always been the Jaguars. And we're finally, after years and years of investing our time and our effort and our loyalty, seeing an ROI, and people are really jazzed about it.
Well, I just thought it was also good, too, is that 23-year-old quarterback, after he wins the game with movie star good looks, right? Where does he head?
Waffle House.
Yes.
That's the most Duval, man. That's where you go, is the Waffle House.
So, why would you go to the Waffle House? It's on Beach Boulevard, right?
Well, that's the one he went to. There's Waffle Houses all over. That is I know you're from New York, but here in the South, Waffle House is the late night party place. It's where you go. Good times, bad times, funerals. You just won the wild card division. You end up at the Waffle House. Doesn't matter what time it is because they're always open. Hurricanes, no problem. They got gas grills. They will cook you food. So it made perfect sense to me that Trevor Lawrence went to the Waffle House. Incidentally, a good friend of mine is vice president of Waffle House. He lives up in Atlanta. And I send him the picture. I go, here you go. Here's one for the books.
Imagine how they benefit from that.
Oh, it's amazing.
And by the way, you know him. You probably read about him all the time. I don't. But I remember the leadership he showed in college when he wanted to get these guys playing again during the pandemic. He comes out and he says, we need to play.
Yeah.
And he played. And he could have used that eligibility and just sat back. Instead, he took a leadership role. So he gets drafted first overall. They don't win the national championship. Gets married before he leaves. Yeah. Seems more mature than I can imagine. But a lot of times those guys don't pan out. And now it turns out he doesn't want to go party after the biggest win of his career. He just wants to eat.
He worked up an appetite, let's be honest. But this guy is the moral center that you want at a football team. This guy, as you said, family man, married young, and he is a leader. Everybody on the team loves this guy.
You see,
my wife follows them all. They all go fishing on the weekends. It's like him and Zay Jones and Etienne. They've been best buds for 6 years. You can really sense that with Doug Peterson, when you go out there, it's a family. And we've had our problems. We've had our Jalen Ramsey. Good corner, not necessarily the most team
oriented.
Showed
up in the Brinks truck.
Yeah, he was all about himself. We had, you know, Justin Blackman for a season, and that didn't end out well. And then, of course, the Urban Meyer debacle last year. So we're really excited to see. Not only do we have a good team on the field, but we got a good team in the locker room. We got a good team in the community, just good guys who are all excited to play, and they're playing really well.
And here's the thing about football, which is so much better than baseball, and I come from a big city. You have a shot at winning, man, how big or small your city is.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why Green Bay's in contention, and they get free agents to the smaller markets, too, because they got salary cap. And you can expand it. You can go by. You can move around it. And that's what makes, I think, football, they got started and started with the salary cap. Baseball doesn't want to accept it. And then the rich teams ignore the luxury tax.
Yeah.
So the Pittsburgh Pirates, the Marlins, are always going to struggle. The great teams like Tampa, who just can put together this great farm system, defy logic. But the Yankees around $300 million. You have the Dodgers, the same thing, and the Pirates are $40 million. It's hard to imagine the same team. That's not the problem in football.
No, we spent big on Christian Kirk. We picked up Evan Ingram. We picked
from
up
the Giants.
Yeah, we from the Giants. Which, and I remember when Evan Ingram was on the Giants, I was like, get him out of here. But this guy, these are guys that are getting a second chance.
Yeah.
Really, our team, it's either brand new recruits or people getting their second chance, and everybody wants to prove themselves. And Doug Peterson's put together a way that they can. And I know Evan Ingram wants to come back, and I'm pretty sure he'll get a very lucrative contract to do that. He was one of the stars of the game. So you're right. It's really, it's really an interesting system we've got here. But we're excited, even if it's just this year, we're excited for it. But we think it's probably a couple years. We've got some good runs coming.
So, spoke about good runs. You're on another one. You continue to have one. Who's coming up on this show today?
Oh, well,
on your show.
On my show, Well, I don't know. What are you doing in an hour? You want to come down? Well, listen, we've got, of course, Martin Luther King Jr. Day that we're going to talk about. I don't know if you've been working with Chat, the AI program, all this artificial intelligence, which they say 93% of the content on the internet will be written by artificial intelligence. So I'm letting them write the majority of my show today.
Fantastic.
We'll walk through some of that.
So we don't know who the real Marquez is.
You never really do. You know, I like to be an enigma. Yeah. And then, of course, we've got more on Joe Biden. I'm unveiling my latest project, the Joe Biden Top Secret Documents Notebook, later today.
Really?
Yeah. So because, you know, Joe Biden leaves his top secret documents everywhere else, I want America to have the chance to do so. So we're making notepads out of top secret documents. We got a lot of stuff. We're going to play some games. We're going to have a lot of fun. Should be an exciting couple of hours.
So, and where will you store this notebook? Near, you know, you don't have a Corvette. You'll put it in your garage when you're not on the air?
I'm going to put it in the garage. I'm going to, well,
near,
I mean,
what kind of car?
That's the, what do I have? I think I have a Lincoln. Yeah. Maybe next to the minivan. Probably no one's going to look near the minivan.
Right.
You know, right under the Christmas decorations. But look, I don't want to tell you because the FBI will come and raid it. And then there goes my whole, my whole kids' college fund.
Well, they raid pretty regularly, Mark. And they have never, they always walk away empty handed. Which is great news. Mark, thanks so much for coming in and letting me use your studios.
By the way, yeah, your coffee should be here now.
You ordered me a Starbucks coffee, but you don't get it.
I don't. What do you mean I don't? Oh, look, here it is right here.
Oh, my goodness.
This is Hannah, my producer.
Hannah, and thank you very much.
There's your almond milk latte that you ordered from Starbucks.
In a bag.
You almost didn't make the cut.
Thank you so much.
I wrote to you. You took like 7.5 minutes to write me
back. I'm on the air.
I understand.
It seems like you don't. But I owe you now. When you come to New York, an almond milk latte or whatever you choose is on me.
All right. I'll see you next week.
All right. Fantastic, Mark. Great. Congratulations on your success, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
All right. And get ready. Mark's going to get in the shower. He's going to get ready for his show shortly. If you're in one of the affiliates of Carrie Mark's show, this is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
No city deserves this. El Paso does not deserve this. Chicago, Washington, Houston, Los Angeles, New York. No city deserves what is happening. This is a beautiful city, and what has happened over the last few months undermined this city. And what is happening in Chicago right now, in New York, in Houston, in Los Angeles, in Washington, our cities are being undermined. And we don't deserve this. Migrants don't deserve this. And the people who live in the cities don't deserve this. We expect more from our national leaders to address this issue in a real way.
How about the President of the United States and Mayorkas? Mr. Mayor, I give you so much credit for going down there. I've been saying to do that a year ago. You go down there, people pay attention. That's why a Democratic mayor of El Paso busing 5,000 to New York, 4,000 to Philadelphia, in Chicago makes a difference because the president knows you can't say it's pure politics. You say it's pure practicality. While you land migrant flights at 2 a.m. in Westchester County Airport or in Jacksonville, Florida. We know this is happening. They're taking illegal immigrants. Now, Mr. Mayor, the way you go to battle to get rid of the bail, the no cash bail law, and I appreciate that, and hopefully people will eventually listen, you have to do the same way with sanctuary cities because you, Chicago, Los Angeles, the Houston, you're all sanctuary cities. So because you sit there, that becomes a magnet. That becomes commercials rolling in these other countries saying, come to New York. You can stay in a luxury hotel and eat for free. You'll be processed and given a bag that includes Nikes and toiletries. And then eventually somebody will hire you. If you could put your foot down on that, get E-Verify, it'll begin to allow things to come down to the border. And then you make the president build up the border and put up the wall, the fence, the barrier that we all paid for. But I love that he went down. I love that he went to the bad sections of the border, not the sanitized part that the president went to. Just go the rest of the way, Mr. Mayor. Brian Kilmeade Show.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show, Martin Luther King Day, a great American who's getting recognized. It's hard to believe when you really think back. He would have been 94, and died gunned down at 38, 39 years old, and see how much he accomplished. We'll talk about that. Race in America, we'll discuss it. Also important, the President of the United States is going to make some remarks. Yesterday, he went to Martin Luther King Jr.'s address, and he'll make remarks today to his church. He'll make remarks today at the National Action Network's annual The Dream Defined Breakfast at the Mayflower Hotel. But we know there's other things on his mind. We have a good couple of guests today. Standing by, Congressman Mike Gallagher and Brett Baer at the bottom of the hour. And we'll take your calls, 1-866-408-7669. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
And let's lay one thing to rest. I may be a practicing Catholic. I used to go to 7:30 Mass every morning in high school and then in college before I went to the black church. Not a joke. Andy knows this.
None of this stuff is ever proven true. And that's Andrew Young. Unbelievable. Remembering MLK. Today, remember his life. We'll discuss Dr. King's dream for America and where it stands.
Number two.
This is a national crisis. FEMA deals with national crises. New York cannot take more. We're pointing the finger where it should be pointed, and that's our national government. This is a national problem.
Yes, at the President of the United States. Mr. Mayor, go the next step. That's the way you do it. New York City's mayor went to the border and actually saw the illegals, saw the problem, saw the gaps in the fence, saw El Paso and the homeless situation and how it's being overrun. Democrat to Democrat, as an American, they know they have a problem. But, Mr. Mayor, you could do one thing to help New York, but you're not.
Number one.
Donald Trump has said from the beginning that he declassified everything, and he points to public statements like a tweet that he sent out saying, I declassified everything. Joe Biden doesn't have any defenses. He has said that anyone that would do this is incredibly irresponsible. And now we've found out that he's done it four times.
It's unbelievable. On Saturday, they found more documents. Docudrama number four, and they found it on his property. The question is, why is the president's legal team still doing the searching as many of his party defenders in the press go into attack mode? With me right now to discuss that and our attack against China, which could unify this country, Congressman Mike Gallagher. He's on Intelligence, Transportation, Infrastructure, and Armed Services. Congressman, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Brian.
First off, do you find it strange? Out of all the investigations I've had, I've never heard a legal team from who's being investigated being allowed to collect the evidence.
It's just crazy. You'd think now would be a time, in light of the ongoing investigation of President Trump and the raid of Mar-a-Lago, yeah, where they would feel like they have to go above and beyond in terms of transparency with this investigation. And thus far, what we've heard from the president has been the opposite of reassuring. I mean, this nonsense where he gets up there and says, well, hey, my Corvette's in a locked garage. I mean, come on. It just betrays how little he knows about how you handle classified information. I mean, unless his garage is itself a sensitive compartmented information facility or SCIF, then that's not a defense at all. Think about just in your own life. What do you keep in your garage? I don't keep, you know, my daughter's birth certificates or any tax documents. You know, I got a snow thrower, I got a lawnmower, I got some assorted kids' bicycles in there. I don't have anything of value that I store in my garage out of security. So it's just crazy. They need to do better. And I think what the American people are most concerned about is not only just the national security implications, but this sense of a double standard. You know, that's what drives people absolutely crazy. It's the hypocrisy and the double standard that really drives ordinary Americans here in Wisconsin crazy.
Absolutely. So you were a Marine, right?
Yes, I was a Marine counterintelligence and human intelligence officer.
So let's say
a lot of time thinking about this stuff.
Right. So let's say that you decided, you know, I had some great memories collecting intelligence. I think I'm going to bring them home with me. So just so I don't forget how great that intelligence was. It, what if they were in the Gallagher estate? How would the Marines look at that?
Well, I'd go to jail. I mean, that would be a clear violation of U.S. law, as well as the, you know, the oaths you take when you get a top secret FBI clearance. In fact, we have recent precedent of government contractors, service members mishandling classified information and being punished for it. And remember, this is a violation of law that does not require malicious intent. The standard is gross negligence. So merely doing it, whether or not you intended something bad for U.S. national security, is enough for grounds of violation. And again, the vice president, because in this case, this was Biden acting as vice president, is not exempt from those laws that a captain or a first lieutenant in the Marine Corps handling intelligence would be exempt from. And there, I think you played a clip from John Ratcliffe. He's absolutely right that at least, and I'm not saying either of these incidents are good, right? We don't want the president, regardless of whether he's part of your party, to mishandle classified information. But Trump at least has the theoretical defense that he has the power to declassify documents, which is true. And Vice President Biden did not have that power.
So I know one of your focuses, I was heartened by the fact, I think over 118 people, Democrats in the House, voted to support your special committee, select committee on China, because China's trying to infiltrate every aspect of our lives. And one of the places they made the greatest progress and have the greatest impact is the money they're pouring into these colleges. The Penn Biden Center had $14 million gift in 2018. We don't know what Joe Biden knew about it, what it has anything to do with him, but the timing seems to be something worthy of an investigation. And they put overall $30 million into the University of Pennsylvania. It's amazing how much interest they have in our education system. Does that worry you? And do you think there's a link should be an investigation should happen?
Absolutely worries me. Absolutely an investigation should happen. And it's related to a broader issue we're hoping to get at on the Select Committee on China, which is our universities are desperate for Chinese money. And they're susceptible, therefore, to malicious influence from the Chinese Communist Party. You know, back in the Trump administration, they started enforcing something called Section 117 of the Higher Education Act, which requires colleges to report foreign gifts and donations over $250,000. And what they discovered when they started enforcing Section 117 of the HEA was over $6.5 billion in previously unreported foreign gifts, grants, and contracts. And what happened when the Biden administration took office is that the number of foreign gifts reported has plummeted, which doesn't add up. So either the foreign money shut off or they're simply not enforcing that section of the law. I've repeatedly written to Secretary Cardona to fix this loophole, but our university is just awash in foreign money, and Chinese students and Chinese grants are very lucrative for these universities, and that makes them susceptible to censoring certain classes or centers that may put the CCP in a bad light. That makes them susceptible to espionage from students with PLA affiliations. That's something we absolutely need to investigate and demand more transparency from the executive branch on.
So I understand you're also taking aim at Disney. You announced a plan to summon the old and now new CEO of Disney and the NBA commissioner, Adam Silver, to appear in front of your committee to talk about the role they're playing with China and what they mean to their league and that organization. What are you looking for? What worries you?
Well, you know, first of all, I admit the complexities involved on the economic side of this whole thing, right? For over two decades, really three, we've been telling American businesses, hey, go to China, do business with them. Let's integrate China into the global economy. It will moderate their behavior. And now we're realizing too late that that was a massive, massive mistake, one of the biggest intelligence failures in recent America.
And that was
history.
Henry Kissinger, too, right? I mean, that was Bill Clinton, Henry Kissinger, both parties. They said, if we bring these people in and show them a market economy, democracies and don't fight each other. So we think we could get them there. And we were wrong.
100%, right? Clinton actually had this phrase when he was arguing for China's accession to the World Trading Organization. You know, he's talking about, hey, good luck trying to keep the internet out of China. That's like trying to nail Jell-O to a wall. Well, they kind of figured out how to nail Jell-O to a wall in that they control the internet in China. They control all these tech companies. They control TikTok. They control WeChat, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of naive assumptions that led us to where we are, but we are where we are. So for Hollywood, for Disney, for major American corporations that want access to the Chinese market, I want them to just be honest with us about the pros and cons of doing business there. And I want to ask hard questions about what the American people are seeing, because the American people see Hollywood censoring certain movies so as not to offend the Chinese Communist Party. They see the NBA, you know, bending the knee to Xi Jinping so that nobody says anything bad about the CCP taking over Hong Kong. They see Disney doing something similar. And I think they're offended by that. We want
American companies to stand up for American values. If they want to make a buck in China, that's fine, but don't do anything that's hostile to freedom of speech in America, freedom of religion, or allows the Chinese Communist Party to get away with genocide and military modernization.
I mean, think about this, though, too, is that never comes up. You know, the crazy thing is with this war on terror, you got to treat the Muslim community with great respect, and we should. You got to watch the Quran. You got to put it in a certain way, and we always should. And now we have another situation where you take tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Muslim Uyghurs, and you put them in a concentration camp. You try to convert them. If not, you torture them, harvest their organs, and Saudi Arabia is meeting with the Chinese leader. I mean, you can't have it both ways. And also, you can't be so condemning of America and at the same time shut your mouth when it comes to China. And I think that they should be called out aggressively for it. And they better be willing to defend. They have to be willing to defend themselves.
I completely agree with that. And the fact is, there's recent laws that have been passed that all of these companies, particularly any company that has a manufacturing presence in China, are going to have to deal with. We passed something in recent years called the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, and it effectively requires companies to certify that their supply chains don't involve slave labor in Xinjiang province. So whether these companies like it or not, they need to be in compliance with the law. And, you know, I think a lot of what we on the committee intend to do is I want this to be a bipartisan forum. I don't want it to be a silly space where people get their, you know, 3 minutes of fame and, you know, they want to get on, you know, Fox News by being, you know, thrown fire and brimstone. But we're going to have to ask hard questions. And I actually think there's bipartisan support in Congress for making sure that American money, American technology, American innovation doesn't subsidize genocide and doesn't allow the Chinese Communist Party to potentially kill Americans in a future war. We just don't want to subsidize our own destruction, and we want to make sure that America is on the best footing to win this new Cold War.
So, Congressman, you must be pleased. When I talked to you about a month ago, you said right now there's no Democrat who wants to serve in this committee. What's the situation now?
We got a lot of interest by a random pool of Democrats, but by Democrats that have backgrounds in national security and foreign policy. You know, there's this concern on the far left that this is going to be a platform for anti-Asian rhetoric. That's silly. It's not going to happen. We're going to tease out how, you know, Asian Americans are one of the primary victims of the CCP. The Chinese people are the primary victims of the CCP, and this is going to be a serious effort. So a lot of Democrats who want to be involved, and we had a big, overwhelming bipartisan vote, 365 right. people in the U.S. House of Representatives. That's a great way to start.
So when are you going to know who's going to be actually do it or if they're going to be held back by leadership?
Hopefully this week. I'm hoping to get our members this week. I'm also actively recruiting our best and brightest on the Republican side. So I'm ready to get rolling, but I need members to do it. I need, you know, committee space. But hopefully this week we'll know more.
So tell us, for the layman, the CHIPS Act, why it's historic and where it falls short. Because I understand it was a Republican idea and it got bipartisan support to be implemented, and it is hurting China's manufacturing.
Well, the thing that's really hurting Chinese manufacturing is some of the export controls that have been put in place by the Commerce Department after the CHIPS Act, which I actually welcome. I think for the CHIPS Act specifically, there's a question of whether the subsidies to American chip manufacturers will have their intended effect in the timeline necessary. Within the next 5 years, are we going to see this explosion of domestic fabs? And my concern is that unless we also commit to really radical regulatory reform, it's going to be very, very difficult to get these fabs up and running. The other thing, as we're seeing in every space, not just chips, but infrastructure in general, is where do you get the human beings to build these things? Whether it's a chip fab or a road or a bridge or, you know, building more Virginia-class subs a year or more small surface combatants in my district, the biggest constraint to growth and to onshoring here in many ways is just the lack of human beings with the requisite skill set and work ethic that can pass a drug test and show up to work every single day. So it's bound up in this bigger workforce challenge, which I think is essential to us successfully competing against China over the long term.
The latest series of crises that they have, and I'm up against a break, but now all those people that were hired to enforce zero COVID restrictions are now out of a job, and they're now rioting in the streets. What do your reports say that you can share with us about China's society? I mean, there's a huge unemployment. Young people don't want to work. And we understand that we saw the unrest with the freedom and the crackdowns and zero COVID. Now the zero COVID people say, well, now we have no jobs. What are you hearing?
Well, two quick points. We tend to, you know, the neo-engagers, the people that just want to go back to business as usual with China, tend to ignore the Chinese people and their aspirations and their dreams. And so we want on this committee to speak directly to the Chinese people and constantly make that distinction between the Chinese Communist Party and the people. The second point is over the long term, really over the next decade, Xi Jinping faces a massive demographic problem. He's got more retirees than any society in human history. So that's a huge challenge. But it's a big but. It could make him more aggressive in the near term, make him more willing to risk war by taking Taiwan. So we have to monitor these things very, very carefully and make sure that our foreign policy is strong.
And there's no successor. He's eliminated all of them. So they live and die with him. Thanks so much. Congressman Gallagher, you're always a great guest. Appreciate it. Best of luck getting some Democratic support in your on your select committee.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
You got it. Back with your calls. Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. 1-866-408-7669.
Getting past all the rhetoric, it's Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back. Britt Baer joining me in about 7 minutes, but now it's your turn. Let's go to Dean, listening on WABC in New Jersey. Hey, Dean.
Brian, how's it going? You know, I so distrust this media, and I know that I could fall into the trap of saying, wow, they're finally going after Biden. That's not it. So I'm
what do you think it is?
Here's what I think it is. They have so much to go after Biden for, and they're picking a documentation where I store documents that he wanted to take out of the White House. That's not it. They could go after him after, you know, with the laptop. They could put him in jail. Anybody can go to jail for what he did with the laptop, and it's so much easier to take him out with that. But they want to take him out the same way they want to take Trump out. Trump is the goal in this whole thing. They don't care about Biden. They'll sacrifice Biden. They'll sacrifice anybody to go after Trump and take Trump out. So they're
this actually makes Trump look better. I mean, it neutralizes Trump. It keeps him alive.
Unless they go after Biden and take Biden out for the same thing that Trump did. And then they could say, well, we're doing the same thing, just what the Republicans want. We're treating them both the same way. And then they go after Trump.
Well, it could. I mean, there's a lot of theories, but no one thinks it's as it appears. They think there's another move behind the scenes, a greater plan. And why is it? Well, one thing's pretty clear. They get new documents every day. And those documents get closer and closer to the number of documents that Trump has. Which means that this makes Trump look better. Maybe they want that.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I think the real interesting part of the special counsel investigation, more interesting than the documents themselves, so we don't know what they are right now, so we're only speculating, will be who made that decision? Ron Klain make that decision?
Who made the decision not to disclose?
Not to disclose. Did Ron Klain make the decision? Did the president make the decision? Who made the decision to not tell the American people 6 days before an election? And if Donald Trump had not told people 6 days before an election, what would the conversation be about right now? I guarantee you it would be about cover-up.
And that's true. And I thought that was an interesting angle. He always gives interesting points. And, of course, Chris Christie has been very critical of the former president of late. With me right now, Brett Baer. Brett, welcome back.
Hey, Brett.
Hey, Brett. So in the interim since we last spoke, I think there's been three document dumps. I guess on Saturday, you thought they would take the weekend off from looking into the estate of Joe Biden, but they found a few other documents. What I find most striking is that his legal team is still allowed to look through his stuff. I thought somebody else would be taking this over.
Yeah, I mean, look, at the FBI obviously was involved in looking at all of the Mar-a-Lago documents. And the question is, are the lawyers even, do they have the classification? Do they have the clearance to be looking through these documents? I don't know that we know that. And it's just handled night and day differently than the former president.
So one thing, this is Bob Bauer in today's Axios. He talks about his personal attorney released the backstory. The backstory is they were looking to move him out November 2nd. And University of Pennsylvania says, you tell me if I'm wrong here, Brett, because you're following this extremely close, too. They didn't tell the Bidens to clear out the office. They did this on their own. And then when they stumble on the classified items, that's when they call the archives, who call the Department of Justice. And when they went through the garage and found the paperwork with the top secret classification, then they called in people, the president's attorney, and then he came in. But you're allowed to stumble on something without clearance. You just can't pick it up. I'm pretty sure. I'm not sure if that's been stated yet, but that seems to be the protocol.
Yeah, but once you're on your second batch of documents, maybe there are other documents. And now we're on our fourth. So it's kind of been, you know, interesting. Every answer from the White House is the president takes handling classified material very seriously. Well, each time there's a new batch, there's a new question. Really? He does? Because it doesn't appear in the way that this is kind of evolving that was a high priority.
Well, the other thing to keep in mind, too, is CBS broke the story in January, but their indications are they might have known about it in November. And the other thing is November 2nd is before November 8th. I just looked at the calendar to confirm. November 8th is a midterm, and that's what Chris Christie's getting at. Whose decision was it to delay this rather than just say, I just got to tell you, we came across these documents. Joe Biden wasn't on the ballot, but Donald Trump and his supporters, Donald Trump's handpicked candidates were. And Obama and Biden were saying how these disdocument cases is a big thing and shows how the MAGA Republicans can't be trusted or stopped. So it did play a role in the rhetoric.
100%. I mean, there were some Democratic candidates who put that as part of their ads about the handling of documents and all the Mar-a-Lago dust-up. So, you know, you can't say, I don't think you can quantify how many votes it shifted, but
right.
it definitely impacted.
I want you to hear what David Gergen said. As you know, he served as a key advisor, national security advisor for Republicans and Democrats in the White House, presidents. Listen.
How big a mess is this for the Biden administration?
It's very, very big. Not legally, but politically, it's a very, very big deal. This is a president who was marching upward. For the first time in his presidency, he's got his numbers up. People are feeling better about the economy. There are all sorts of reasons to believe that he can now present himself. The fears that people like me have about how old is he and can he govern well, those fears would be dissipated if he were able to stay on that track. Mm. But now along comes this gigantic story, which was totally unexpected, and it's knocked for six. The original plan.
So, I mean, David Gergen is not looking to rip Joe Biden. He's somebody, you know, to me, he leans left. But how significant is his statements and assessment?
I think it's significant. I mean, it's any of those kind of elder statesmen of politics when they say things. Dan Balls with the Washington Post, David Gergen, others. I think it's definitely significant politically and one in which, you know, the White House is going to have to deal with, and it hurts the president. I think there are Democrats out there looking at the president saying this story actually makes him more vulnerable than they thought he was.
And might be, just like they're looking at Trump and say, should I run against Donald Trump? They might be saying, should I run against Joe Biden? A different story November 10th, when it looks as though when he holds the Senate and he barely loses the House. As maybe right now, because we also don't know what other documents are going to be found and what links they're going to have to the University of Pennsylvania and possible China. Have you gone there yet? Brett, do you feel as though that is a path that needs to be investigated?
Well, 100%. I mean, you need to know what the documents are. I thought one of the interesting first answers the president gave was, my lawyers told me not to ask about the documents. Well, what do you mean? You had the documents. You were using them. You don't know what they are, and your lawyers told you not to ask about it? It doesn't make sense, and the fact that there's a special counsel for both the former president and now the president is, politically tough.
Brett Baer helping us out here. Brett, when it comes to legal immigration, I was struck by the bipartisan Senate committee. I guess I'm trying for hope that went down to the border to assess what it was really like, to include Senator Kelly and Senator Sinema and Senator Murphy on the left. And then I see Eric Adams, who says he's got 40,000 illegals here, 5,200 just from El Paso. The mayor of New York City went down there, and he went to the bad parts. He actually saw illegal immigrants. He saw the gaps in the fences. Cut 26.
No city deserves this. El Paso does not deserve this. Chicago, Washington, Houston, Los Angeles, New York. No city deserves what is happening. This is a beautiful city. And what has happened over the last few months undermined this city. And what is happening in Chicago right now, in New York, in Houston, in Los Angeles, in Washington, our cities are being undermined. And we don't deserve this. Migrants don't deserve this. And the people who live in the cities don't deserve this. We expect more from our national leaders to address this issue in a real way.
He didn't mention the president. He's a Democrat. The El Paso mayor is a Democrat. But this is something that might be able to move the needle. The expected number of encounters in December, an all-time high, 250,000, let alone the gotaways. There are millions of people here that don't belong. The border's virtually collapsed. How significant is a Democratic mayor making that speech?
Well, it's very significant. You saw Gavin Newsom from California, the governor, going to the border, saying Democrats need to push this issue, address this issue. The White House did not. They didn't talk about it for a long time. They didn't put it as a high priority. And those cities along the border, like El Paso, are overwhelmed. They can't take it. El Paso is one of the mayors, one of the local jurisdictions that sent migrants to other cities. And Mayor Adams is correct. It is a big problem, but it's only being shared that way because the border is getting those migrants to other places.
It's going to be big. It's going to be interesting and see where it goes. Brett, can't thank you enough for joining us. Special report tonight at 6?
You bet. We'll be there.
All right. Brett Baer, it's going to be a big week. Make sure you're listening to Fox News and, of course, this show. Brett Baer, thank you. When we come back, we'll finish up with your calls, 1-866-408-7669. In beautiful Jacksonville, Florida, where the Jaguars pulled up a mammoth upset on Saturday, big comeback. And then the Giants pulled off the upset of the weekend against Minnesota. And, of course, everything else that's important. You don't want to miss a minute. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back. Special thanks to everyone here in Jacksonville, WOKV Studios. It's just fantastic here, and everyone went out of their way, got up early. For many, it was a day off just to make sure everything was set. And for Josh, Pete, and Allison, doing such a great job. But I'm just realizing, I'm checking my watch, I think it's time to see, and we'll take some calls on the back end. Well, time to see if you need to know more.
More to know. Sponsored by Unplugged. Reclaim your privacy from big tech snooping with Unplugged. Visit unplugged.com.
While many of you misguided Americans were focusing on football, I was focusing on Miss Universe. And the winner is our Bonnie Gabriel. We'll tell you what's unique about her, the 71st Miss Universe competition, after we hear her win.
The new Miss Universe is...
So she's a Filipino-American, the first to win Miss USA on Saturday night in the International Beauty Pageant in New Orleans. She's a fashion designer, model, and sewing instructor from Texas. Beat out 83 others. Good job. Next, some of the many great games. Giants win 31-24 over the Vikings. Daniel Jones, unbelievable. Rush for over 70 yards. Pass for over 300 yards, 2 touchdowns. They'll play the Eagles next. Saquon Barkley, 53 yards, but if you watch the game, you know how valuable he was. They'll play 8:15 on Saturday. I'll be able to stay up and watch, but that is trouble because it clashes with One Nation. Oops, next. Bengals, Sam Hubbard scores the Ravens fumble to help Cincinnati win over Baltimore 24-17. So Baltimore's about to score. They're playing without Lamar Jackson. And then we keep in mind, Tyler Huntley, not much experience, goes to dive in, but he put the ball up in the air when he's supposed to go down. Listen to what happened as the result.
Put them right around Huntley. He reaches. Oh, that ball's out. That's live. Back the other way. Sam Hubbard, the Cincinnati kid. Hubbard's got a convoy. Chased by Andrews. At the 30, the 20, he will score.
14-point swing gave the Bengals a 24-17 lead and eventually the victory. Other news, Miami Dolphins' Mike McDaniel kind of blew it, a delay of game call when it was 4th and 1. He didn't get the call in time and ends up being 4th and 6, a 5-yard penalty. He said he made a mistake. I want you to hear, if we can, Josh, McDaniel explain what happened with the delay of game.
It was communicated to me through the upstairs from the headset, I think. I was standing by an official. I had just had gotten convicted information that it was a first down. So I don't really know exactly who it was from. It was probably the first time all year that had happened. So you try to do your best. As it was, I thought we had a 4th and 6 opportunity that we were unable to come up with as well. So 4th and 1 most of the time is easier than 4th and 6. But at the same time, you just have to adjust to whatever variable is put out there. And, you know, I think we had a chance at the 4th and 6 as well.
Well, number one, I never expected Miami to be so close. Final score 34-31. The Bills did not look good compared to what they're supposed to be. They got to get it together for next week. They've been through a lot. I understand it. Next. Now, something that really needs to be addressed, and I should have led with this. Who is deciding where I should read this? The best of the potato chips, top 5 mouthwatering crisps most recommended by experts. And true, there are potato chip experts out there who don't get enough credit. Number 5, Ruffles, cheddar and sour cream. Yes, 2 flavors. Then number 4 is just Ruffles. So the people of Ruffles had 2 reasons to celebrate. Are they a separate division, the cheddar and sour cream, or just Ruffles lives on the west side and the east side is just... I think they should both go to the same Christmas party. Number 3, Cape Cod Originals. What's that? Zapp's Voodoo Chips? I've never seen them. And Lay's potato chips. The thing that gets me about Lay's, sometimes they hurt. I mean, they're so fine, they become little, very, very sharp objects. But congratulations to all potato chips who participated. Again, Pringles came up with the technology to stack them. How they're not in the top 5, I don't know. Next. 7 in 10 Americans make sure to have snacks with them at all times. That, according to a poll of 2,000 people, 70% admit that they always bring some kind of snack. At least 3 times a week, over 51% will even fill up on snacks. How dare you? You were told not to. In fact, 6 of 10 people confess that their first choice of snack is a sugar or salt-laden one, with the most popular choices being, again, back to potato chips, 56%. Chocolate 55% and candy 45%. Again, you can run with that study. Good luck at your next barbecue. You'll be the only fascinating person there. Next, scientists at the University of Otago in New Zealand reveal that children who don't get enough sleep eat more calories than their well-rested peers. Next, 2/3 of parents agree kids have it much better today. This is fascinating. A random study by Disney Mini Brands of 2,000 parents and children, 5 to 18, say 2 in 3 parents admit their kids' childhoods have been much better than theirs because they believe their children have more opportunities in life, 65%, more access to tech, 57%, and more affection than they did as kids, 56%. We're reflecting on their youth, 83% are glad they grew up in an era they were born in. And by the way, 81, a similar percentage think growing up in this year is much harder than they were as a child. If time travel were possible, and I don't think it is. I'm going to look into this. I'm going to Google it after. 2 in 3 Americans would transport themselves back to their childhoods. I would not, for one.
What's a piece of tech that your children have access to that you can look at and say, man, if I only had that, you could have done this, this, or that?
I don't know. I would assume... I mean, just flat out Google. There was no such thing. I mean, you had an encyclopedia. You had to look it up. Like, there was no brain room. Well, not everybody has a brain room. I have a brain room I could call. There was no brain room I could call to find out, you know, what is going on. But I will say this. I do think it's hard growing up in this era, but no harder than anything else. There's pluses, minuses to everything. People point out to the 50s, but the 50s was huge problems. I do want to bring up, it's Martin Luther King Day. I do want to say that I just do think that things have gotten so much better over the last 2 years. I think there's no doubt about it. I think people are appreciating it more. In fact, Charles Love joined me on One Nation over the weekend. He's on one half of Cut the Bull podcast and said this about today, Cut 22.
One, the fact that we've come a long way and pay attention to where we've been and what that fight is. And two, to come from a positive place, not only focus on the negative, fix the problems, but there's joy in all this history. And he, his father and his grandfather being college graduates. So to assume that everything about being black in America is negative is a problem.
It is. And lastly, when it comes to Joe Biden, he has really hurt things, didn't help them. Cut 23.
When you're saying things like we're living in Jim Crow 2.0, I always joke that when I think of a 2.0, I think of the new improved, the stronger version. So you're implying that what we're dealing with today is worse, and it just comes from a point of just total illogic.
It is. Again, he would have been 94 years old, died at 39 years old, and I just think it's important to see where we come. And I did, Ben Jealous was on at a different hour. And he's founder of the NAACP, supremely educated from Oxford to Harvard on down. Great guy. I don't think that critical race theory is just teaching that we had slaves. I think it is so much more. It's an anti-American approach to education. And I think it says that America is built to it on stolen land off the backs of slaves. And to me, that's not the case. Were Native Americans here? Yes. Let's talk about it. Was there slavery here? Yes. Let's talk about it. Was there... separate but equal, yes. But look at where we are and what we've been through, and we are the best country in the world. Brian Kilmeade.